Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
And as always, from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jairam.
And you're listening to The Coast
to Coast
Bio
Podcast.
Hey, Hari, how are you?
I am very fine. And you?
Not bad. Actually, at home for a weekend. So,
yeah, same here. This is my first weekend in like a month that I'm not at the synchrotron or something. So it feels good.
Well, actually, I mean, I try and make it home for the weekends, but there has been a lot of travel, and it doesn't seem like there's any end in sight. So it's going to be an interesting few weeks.
And you were at some conference, right?
I wouldn't call it a conference. It was more like a meeting which had been organized by the folks at Illumina, where they had invited, you know, a bunch of people in the next-gen sequencing community, other sequencing vendors, genome centers, translational research centers, individual PIs, and things like that, and some of the infrastructure providers out there. So I was there from the Amazon Web Services side.
Infrastructure providers, as in like
hardware companies, cloud providers, things like that. Yeah. So I was there representing Amazon. It was a great meeting. It was 2 days. It was pretty intense. I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. And so it was great. One of the things I came away with was that, you know, we're essentially in this place where you almost, by the nature of the beast, by the amount of work you have to do, have this concept of data producers, data consumers, who would be the biologists in the end, and methods developers, the informatics crowd. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this relationship evolves. Because I think in the past, one group or one center, you know, one sort of research group could manage a lot of these things in one place. But now, with the amount of data being generated and the costs involved, it's going to be interesting to see how this relationship evolves.
Wow, that's really cool. And how big was it? Like 1,500 people?
No, about 35 people, I think. 30 to 35 people. Mm-hmm. It was very small. That's what made it so interesting.
So, yeah, and it's really cool that all these people are sitting together in these small forums to, like, figure stuff out because, as you were saying, no one of them has the key, right? Everybody has to do it as a group. So was Google there too? Or
yeah, they were there as well. In fact, the guy had the coolest business card. It said Software Laureate. And, I think his wife had suggested that he call himself that.
Goodness.
Yeah. it was definitely very interesting. I think it comes from the fact that I think people decided, instead of all of us trying to solve the problem our way, let's get together and see if we can solve it as a group. And what I was also very pleased to see was there was no, you know, very often in such cases, everybody says, oh, let's go and just make a big committee.
Yeah.
And do it that way. And it didn't look like that. Heck, at the end, people are proposing hackathons.
Yeah. Everything's agile now. Nobody believes in, you know, sitting and talking about stuff. Just start building it. That's what's nice.
Yeah, which was cool. And they also invited people like Jimmy Lin from Maryland, who's not a scientist. He does work with NCBI because he's in Maryland. Mm-hmm. What he does is teaches classes on MapReduce at Maryland. And a lot of his students have built bioinformatics applications. And it was great hearing him give a talk on not only MapReduce, but things like PIG and sort of basically on distributed computing. And there are a few of us who talked.
What's PIG?
PIG is sort of an analytics package, analytics language system built on top of Hadoop. Google has an equivalent called Sawzall.
I was seeing that.
PIG is very similar to Sawzall.
S-O-S-O,
S-A-W-Z-A-L-L. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so Sawzall and PIG are very similar. So it was different. You know, this whole idea of really fault-tolerant, distributed key-value pair-based, key-value-based storage and analytical techniques, which is not what most life science people are into. But I did find it interesting that a lot of them had thought about it.
Cool.
And were thinking. The challenge is monumental. If you look at the kind of budgets and thinking that some of these guys have in mind and what they're being faced with, it's incredible. I mean, when was the last time the life science, you know, centers had to actually think about the fact that they don't have enough power?
Yeah, probably around the time they were buying thousands, tens of thousands of ABIs or something like
No, not even
that.
that.
Yeah.
Those don't take up as much comp the power is being used up by the IT infrastructure.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and they never needed that kind of infrastructure before. I mean, those old machines were too slow in producing information, data. So that was very cool. So yeah, that was my week. What about you?
Nothing. I've just been trying to figure out how to phase this particular membrane protein, and that's about all I've been doing, and still struggling. So that's why I've done so little extracurricular reading in the last week that I feel like, I don't know what went on really.
I don't know if you saw my thing on friend feed where I said something like, "How can you predict innovation or something like that when it takes for when you have no idea whether a protein will when you'll be able to crystallize a protein, you know, when there's you know real practical challenges which there is no timeline on. You can't say it's going to
Yeah,
happen
exactly.
because it's these things are temperamental."
Yeah, no, and then and we all know, like, I mean, that whole singularity crap. I mean, give me a break. If you just know how difficult things are,
Yeah.
you will probably not talk about the singularity as though it were, around the corner. No,
Yeah, I mean,
sorry, probably unrelated. But it's like whenever I hear of people talking about, anything that involves proteins, and if only they knew how temperamental these things are, and there's no engineering way to get your way out of this problem. It's just, anyway, that's a different story.
Yeah, no, but yeah, the way you, Chris, I mean, I was thinking of you when I actually put that in, and you know, I remember back in the day. When even these big structural genomics companies were coming around, the reason they gave up was that they could never, they built pipelines that were very efficient, but they could never get over the crystallization problem.
Yep. And I
They're
guess, it's going to be one of those things that the technology will have to be kind of redirected to other things like expression technologies and things like that, rather than just solving structures. I think that's anyway,
And
that's
which
I
is what
guess.
happened, which is what ended
Yeah,
up happening. I think people,
exactly.
what people ended up doing was really figuring out, well, a lot of the quality in prediction is a result of what happened then. A lot of
Right.
the, you know, conditions and the expression systems happened because of all of that. The whole robotics involved with the process, the process got really improved. But in
Right.
the end, biological systems are biological systems. They do what they want to do.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's just the nature of the beast. So anyway, we have a pretty interesting lineup today. It's quite diverse, actually. And the first thing I wanted to talk about was this post I saw in Genome Technology, which talks about a huge NCRR grant to USC to establish a quote-unquote ultimate informatics infrastructure. I always love those. Basically, it's a big grid computing framework. And idea,
Right.
I guess, it would tie into the Open Science Grid and other grids. And it's built on Globus, which I have major issues with anyway. I don't think Globus is the best system out there, but that's me. But what I found interesting, what I find amazing is that these are all grant-funded studies, and we really need to figure out how we're going to fund these infrastructure-based projects if we're going to do it and think they're important enough. Because the last paragraph of the whole thing, I think you pointed it out as well, is, and I'll just read out. The USC team hopes that by the time the funding dries up, the project would have gained enough traction that many other institutions would be willing to step in and help support its deployment. 5 years is a long time from now, but certainly at that point, we would hope that some of the elements of this would become widely supported and just become part of the basic science infrastructure, much like the internet is. And that is.
Oh, crazy statement.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's funny that, if it's infrastructure, it shouldn't be tied into such mechanisms of funding cycles. Like, I remember when the PDB, the Protein Data Bank, had to switch hands, right? There was a big
Oh yeah, the
UN
big
cry about it.
fiasco.
Yeah, it was a big fiasco. It became very political, and there were a lot of lobbying going on. And but I mean, in the end, right, if it's something that's infrastructure, when the funding dries up, I don't know. It should never dry up. I mean, these should be things that are always funded. It's like you can't unplug a database just because the funding went away, right? And it just scares me when you see, such expenditures that are going in, assuming that, you know, the usage will catch up and people just find the money 5 years from now. I don't know. It's something that sounds very wrong about that approach.
5 years for an infrastructure project, first of all, by the time they figure out what the infrastructure is, half of it's going to be over.
Yeah,
how exactly. are they going to sustain it? The whole idea of infrastructure sustainability, you know, every 2-3 years, you have to keep refreshing. You have to build an IT system. I think that's one of the biggest problems with academic infrastructure, which is why you need independent funding bodies. I think you need to figure out a different form. This 5-year funding model for infrastructure projects at this scale doesn't make sense to me. And it never has. Right. And I think...
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because just in crystallography, right, we have a lot of software now that's, you know, hosted on SourceForge and Google Code and so on, right? We are not waiting for infrastructure grants to say, okay, here's 22.6 million, set up this thing in 5 years, and then if you're still kind of, you know, enjoying enough user support, we'll give you more money. Instead, people are like, you know, I don't want to deal with this. I'm just going to put it out in the public space, you know, use Google's infrastructure, whatever, to host it, right? And then you don't really
worry
about
Google's
money
infrastructure?
Drying up. Huh?
What do you mean use Google's infrastructure?
No, for example, like Google Core. Yeah, you know what? I'm just saying, right? It just sounds funny that you're going to fund something to build. I mean, it's great, right? Build the technology up, but once the money dries up, when I read that last paragraph, I was just like, okay, it's a good idea, but it just sounds a little scary to think that if it doesn't catch on, you've just spent 22.2 million in 5 years on building something that'll go away, you know, and... Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think the funding agencies have to figure this out.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a more, I mean, nothing against the people who build this. Maybe it'll be amazing, and in the first year, it'll become like the greatest thing ever, and we'll all always use it, and then I shall gladly pay for it. But anyway, I just feel that there's so much open infrastructure out there that, especially for things computational, you know, it'll be better to have NI spend its money for other things. But I don't know, maybe I have vested interest in this.
Yeah, I mean, I've never understood it. I mean, I understand supercomputing centers. I understand places like Argonne and NCSA. You know, those are funded the right way. Those tend to have a mechanism in place. But these random ones, you know, I don't get it. Maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
Okay, sort of moving on from that to something completely different, I mean, away from infrastructure. Saw a press release on FriendFeed today about Innocentive and Nature Publishing Group announcing a partnership to facilitate open innovation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you had a chance to see this. I know you've looked at Innocentive more than I have. Mm-hmm. I basically know about it from the fact that when they got spun out of Lilly, I noticed it, and it sounded like an interesting idea at the time.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, somebody asked me to invest in it. I'll be like, I don't have any money. I can't invest in anything. But what are your thoughts on this? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what my thoughts are, quite frankly.
Well, I just find it funny when you have, you know, the Nature Publishing Group, which obviously is doing a lot of great things in the field of, you know, the web and science, and then they get involved with something like Innocentive, which is kind of more like performing science. You know, it seems like a strange bedfellow, actually. It would almost be like if Nature started its own labs or something, you know, or Nature started becoming something more than a science content delivery company, right? It just sounds a little odd that Nature Publishing Group will be teaming up with, you know, a marketplace or whatever, a talent marketplace like Innocentive. I mean, I thought Innocentive was doing well. I mean, other than the fact that most of the things you see on there sound ridiculous. Like, I'm just reading it, right? Approaches for shortening clinical oncology trials, right? This is a challenge reward for somebody who's seeking a more efficient manner by which to conduct clinical trials. And the reward offered is 10,000. In general, I don't know, I guess I'm very cynical, but whenever I read Innocentive proposals, it's like cure for cancer award, you know, $50,000. You know, it's probably overly cynical, but I don't I it's a great thing. Incentives, obviously, there's enough people who've gotten a lot of great things done using an incentive, but my thought about them teaming up with NPG is like, I wonder how either of them benefit from something like this.
Yeah, so here's my take on it, and this is without really giving it that much thought because I saw it today. I actually immediately went and signed up for Incentive. And the way I look at it is, I think nature is trying to figure out what its business model in the future is going to be. Take a look at what O'Reilly did, right? They started off as a book publisher, and over time they've become a conference organizer, they've become an analyst company, they have a VC arm. They've diversified quite a bit as, publishing itself is not a money-making enterprise anymore. Just look at every newspaper in the world. We lost a PI this week in Seattle. And so this is my guess. I have no idea whether this is reality. Maybe they just thought it was a cool thing to get involved with. Maybe they got approached and they just said, not bad. Because they have their job boards and things like that, thinking about it in that respect. And, so the incentive idea sounds great. I mean, it's like, crowdsourcing for experts. And it's not the only game like this in town. There's a couple of others that I think didn't come out of pharma. I think there's one that came out of Procter & Gamble, which is very similar. Or maybe Innocentive is the one that Procter uses a lot. But what I found really surprising, and maybe this is what nature wants to change, if they can do it, that'd be great. Because if when I looked at the challenges, I had to, the two that I looked at, which looked interesting, I didn't have enough information there to figure out if this was interesting to me or not. It said something random and very general. Then you had to fill up this form to get more information. And to me, that just defeats the purpose completely.
Well, yeah, see, that's the thing, right? A lot of these proposals are coming from within industry, so you obviously don't want to tell them, okay, I figured out 60% of the puzzle, you've come in the 40% because you have a very strong interest in protecting the IP of that 60%. So it just seems like a very strange mixture of, yeah, you sign up, then they tell you what they want, and they tell you a lot more than what you initially. So, it's a cat and mouse game, and it just makes me feel like, why should I even bother? But of course,
So
I'm an academic, and
no, I think they're handcuffing themselves. So here's my theory. If it was something that critical, that it needs to be that secret, you don't put it out on Innocentive anyway. You seek people out because you can't afford to futz around hoping somebody'll figure it out. What you want to put on there are these sort of long shots and things that are doable with somebody with general knowledge, somebody with interested. Like you want to figure out a chemical process, you don't have time, to put an FTE on that. You put it out there, put some money on it. Something you might hire an intern for in a summer. This doesn't, you don't have to hire an intern. You put it out there and somebody solves it. Great. If nobody does, big deal. I mean, to me, that's what would come on something like incentive. If
I
you want
guess
to
for
take.
some things it makes a lot of sense, which quick solutions can be gotten from the crowdsourcing perspective. But for a lot of these projects, it seems fairly involved, and I don't know. We should find out, actually. I'm sure they're doing very well. I mean,
I
there's
think they are. I mean,
always
they.
stuff on there. It's like I get emails very often with challenges that match my keyword profile.
There's one that's pretty interesting, actually, right now. It's got $150,000 award. To so this so here is in, it's interesting. It does give you more information. It is working with this seeker to design a stable trimer design, the Rockefeller Foundation. So it tells you who it is. To design a stable trimer design that would be a good mimic of the functional HIV envelope spike trimer and could be evaluated as an immunogen to elicit neutralizing antibodies and used for crystallization and determination of the trimer structure. Get to work, man.
$150,000. Yeah, sure. It probably makes sense if I'm 80% of the way there. But this is like a 5-year, I mean, yeah, it could be solved overnight, but something tells me no. We used to do the spike protein. I saw that it was on the front page.
Yeah, it's on the
And
front
the
page.
problem I have with most of incentive thing, maybe I'm very cynical, but I see the challenge reward and I say, there's no way. I mean, I probably, yeah, it doesn't hurt to try, but if I'm a lab, an academic lab, I don't know, and or if I'm an industry lab, right? Unless it's just the rewards offered for most of these things just sound way too short of, I mean, especially in the life sciences, right? 150,000, yeah, maybe you'll get it done in like 6 months, but something tells me no, especially given the constraints, right? It has to be active, it has to be an active trimer, it has to elicit an immune response. Yeah, sure. You know, if I had all that, I'd just,
Well, at
you
least
know.
this one tells you what it's about.
Oh, so your problem is more with the fact that it's like,
There
yeah,
are others
the,
that are
yeah.
completely opaque.
Right. Cool. I wonder
And,
what others think about, you know, how inattentive is. Actually, I'm waiting to meet someone who's actually, whatever, done something on inattentive and, you know, solves a problem. That'll be really cool. I
I
think
mean,
it's
for
a cool
example, with
idea,
like,
but I just find, you know, when I read most of these proposals in the life sciences area, especially, I just think they're so far-reaching. And the challenge, I mean, most of these are like full R01 grant quality of, you know, what do you call work.
Yeah,
And
I'm
the
just
challenge,
look.
yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm just
Anyway.
looking at the front page. You know, something that might be interesting is clustering algorithm for two-dimensional data,
Right. See, things
right?
like that, yeah, I can
This is
see,
what
you
I clicked on, but it tells you nothing.
know. Yeah.
The,
More efficient permutation models and mixed models for genome analysis. Right,
yeah.
35,000. Yeah, I guess things like this, you know,
But see,
like
software and informatics, it'll make sense because those
it
are,
makes sense, right?
yeah.
But I'm sure, like, something tells me a lot of the projects that are awarded, I have been following some of them, actually go to like hardcore process, you know, chemistry kind of chemistry, life science kind
And
of.
that's not surprising. I mean, Innocentive has its roots in chemistry.
True,
Process
yeah.
chem, you know, it comes out of Lilly and it's Proctor. I mean, I think people like that are pretty active on it. So, yeah, I'd
Yeah.
love to find out what the success is. And I actually have there, when they were looking for investment round, they sent me paperwork. I could probably look, track it down and see,
Yeah,
you
and
know.
no, I mean, I think just gauging by the number of proposals that are on there, I think it's been immensely successful. I mean, because you see so much stuff now on an incentive, that means it obviously works, right? I mean, why would anyone post on a, you know, what do you call it,
Yeah,
on
the
Craigslist if you never sold anything, you know? So.
thing. Yeah, so here's the thing. There's this whole seeker. There's a challenge on sustainable packaging for 25K. If somebody had an idea on that, wouldn't they keep it to themselves?
I guess they are challenging the very premise of incentive, right? Is
Yeah,
that
I know.
we solve
I'm
problems
trying to.
together.
Maybe I'm just stupid, and I don't understand why somebody would put a challenge like this for
Right.
25K.
Yeah. I guess
Anyway.
maybe they're not looking for full solutions. That could also be possible, right? Anyway,
Need to anyway.
it'll be nice to,
I need
yeah.
to dig into this more.
Cool.
It's a fabulous concept.
Oh, it is. It's great. I mean, but I agree with what you said. You know, it would help if they had a lot more information up front. Because what are they scared of, right? I mean, if they're scared, as you said, they'd rather do it themselves. And if they're not, just tell us everything. You know, you'll have like, I'm sure that'll really benefit, the process will benefit from openness on that front. But hey, maybe we have to look more before we throw any more stones. Yeah.
Bob's there way without really saying anything.
Yeah.
I mean, but maybe next time we should talk about iBridge networks because I find them very interesting as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've known them.
Yeah, they're a tech transfer network which they've been working with Science Commons and things like that.
I see.
And I don't know how successful they are because it's another one of these really nice ideas. So, alrighty. I mean, maybe Innocentive's target market is people like me who've got like a few hours a week and don't mind doing something silly. But these aren't silly projects. I mean, they're full-time
Yeah,
projects in some
exactly.
cases.
So I wonder who their market is. All right, maybe some people out there who have actually used it will let us know.
And sort of moving away to a completely, I mean, we are really jumping
Yeah.
genres this time as opposed to our usual stick to two or three things approach. ChemSpider has been very active. I think part of that has to do with the fact that there was an ACS meeting in Salt Lake City. Might have happened last week. It's been a while since I went to one of these. And so they released InChiKey resolvers and a bunch of other things. They also, yesterday or today, Anthony Williams had a blog post which says that ChemSpider is coming soon to a phone in your hand. Now, basically, it'll be they're coming up for Windows Mobile first and then the iPhone. It's an app. If you just look at the screenshot that they have, it's a proof of concept. And basically, you can look at structures, suppliers, properties of like compounds, which is really cool. And I've seen other people do similar things. Like I saw somebody, I think David Botka, or whatever his name is, I forget, John Botka. David Botka, the guy I used to work with. John Botka, Vertex, forget his name. When he was still the CEO, showing work that they were trying to do at Vertex in enabling iPhone applications that would enable people inside the company to do stuff.
I've not seen
From
this.
the, yeah. So, I'm not in a lab anymore. You are. And, although you're in an academic lab, whether it's an iPhone or some other handheld or mobile device that allows you to look up inventory, look up reagents, where do you find the value? Maybe not in the short term, but in the longer term.
Well, I think a lot of the value in the long term is obviously there, because you have a fairly, sophisticated, whatever computational platform right in your palm, and more than just a calculator and a timer. Like, we have people in our lab that use it as a timer, because it's handy. You carry it around all the time, things like that. But I don't know. It's I think. Once everything starts moving out of the cell phone and they become like, bigger screens, and which is already happening, I think there's immense value. And I think more than, so there's two things, right? There's the fact that it's going to be the platform of tomorrow, right? It's already is such a major platform, and the talent that it receives in terms of developer like focus will be so good that a developer who's writing something would probably write it for the iPhone. And so the next big applications, right? Like something like this, I'm sure already exists on the web, but it's useful to have it right there when you're walking around lab or, doing your experiments. And if you're able to sync data directly to your device, which I'm sure a lot of these applications allow you to do, there's really a lot of power in carrying your data around with you like that. It's a little more than you're just your lab notebook sitting back there or something. But I think in the future, yeah, it's going to be really cool to have these applications available, on your basically palm smartphone, right? But that being said, most of the things are just gimmickry, like you have a molecular viewer on your iPhone or something. It's stupid. I'm like, I can't see anything, that screen's just too small for me
Yeah, I
to
actually think that the value comes in things like these. Figure out which reagent.
Oh yeah, or
Yeah,
database
which.
lookups, stuff
Yeah,
like that, which is
those
already
are
on the
more.
web. So in
Yeah.
a way, I guess the value will come from having new paradigms for like querying quickly, right? Like, for example, right now I still have to use a browser, to query PubMed or something. It'll be cool to have an app that leverages, the iPhone's very excellent UI concepts to search PubMed faster, which I'm sure is going to be out there soon,
Well,
right? And that
especially
changes
since
everything.
they are integrating Spotlight into the iPhone, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Things like that. And if you can start, I mean, there's no limit, right? It's after all just a computer. So I'm sure there's a lot of value. And I think once you get people used to doing everything on their phone or doing everything on their smartphone, then the sky's the limit in terms of what people will actually start doing. I was watching this stuff about touch interfaces and how actually Paul Emsley, the developer of Qt, was talking about using the Wii APIs to control, visualization in Qt. I mean, these aren't new ideas by far for visualization, but I think the value will come from people who are using these new concepts to quickly make killer, applications and make science easier. So yeah, I'm very excited, and these APIs tend to be written so well that it's easier to develop an app on the iPhone API than probably do it in, using whatever the some other API set, So I think that's why it's cool, because these companies have invested a lot of energy in building powerful APIs for things they think are important. And the APIs are so powerful that it's easy for scientists to use those APIs to do things that they think are important. So that we benefit from the energy put into, the APIs, which probably they haven't put in into, say, APIs for the desktop. So I don't know. I think that's where a lot of this
Yeah,
value is.
I agree. And that's the advantage of something like the iPhone APIs, because they've been made robust for a variety of applications. The things that at least, I mean, naively maybe, think that would be very useful for us, like you're in your lab space and you want to say, oh, which refrigerator is this sample in? And you do a quick lookup. and you can find it. Or think something, you know, the coolest thing I've ever seen anybody do is launch a 100 node cluster from their iPhone. But that was really cool. You know, I think things like finding that out of, you know, medical information, of course, it's pretty obvious, like quick look up.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Or something like, hey, what are these, you know, maybe you have a lab notebook somewhere and you are not at your lab and you want to figure out, oh, what were the crystallization conditions I used for something? You just quickly look it up on your mobile
phone. I guess database look, you know, kind of database driven applications. It's such an obvious front end to have right there. You know, actually, it's funny. The thing I wrote for doing crystallization gradients, right? I wrote it in Python and stuff. And I'm to be frank, I'm really thinking of having the GUI done on an iPhone, because most people in my lab who do crystal trials have iPhones. And since it does use a lot of, you know, Cocoa or whatever, very usable concepts to do the UI, right? I mean, very cool concepts to do the UI. I'm like, maybe I'll just learn the iPhone API so I can do it as an iPhone app, because I don't care at that point, you know, as long as people can make their screens, you know, if they use an iPhone, so be it. So yeah, I think there's a lot of things, and this is just like the beginning, you know. The gimmickry is kind of getting done, and now we are getting into serious apps like this one.
Let's see. Yeah, and I think that's the cool part. I'm like kind of looking forward to people doing even, you know, it's not just the games. I mean, the iPhone makes a great game platform, and there's all kinds of usable. I mean, I use Evernote on the iPhone heavily, for example.
Yeah, see, exactly. You know, that would be awesome, right? I'm sure a lot of iPhone people use Evernote in labs, so that in itself is a huge plus, you know, to have your phone by your experiment, by your typing into it or whatever.
Yeah, or maybe just look something up for reference. I mean, as a reference manager, as a quick, you know, and these interfaces are only going to get better. So it'll be very interesting to see how this whole field plays out over time. Anyway, so that was our geek moment. Quite coincidentally, both you and I ended up putting a whole bunch of links about scalable backends, I think independent of each other. Since you put most of them, I'll let you start talking about it, and then we can sort of decide where this conversation is going to go.
Okay, cool. So actually, I wasn't planning on putting... you know, we've all heard about Twitter. It's enjoying this explosive growth, and everybody's talking about it. But the aspect of Twitter that really caught my attention was you know, it was famous for having scalability issues. And I heard this first in the Java Posse podcast on how they solved a significant amount of their scalability issues by adopting this language called Scala or Scala, which is, I don't know, it's probably less than a year old or probably around one or 2 years.
It's been around, but it's one of these.
It's really started gaining traction now. Yeah. And, you know, so Scala is a language that runs on the JVM, so the Java Virtual Machine. And the Java Posse podcast, which I listened to, they were very excited about Scala. And they said it was remarkable how quickly Twitter adopted Scala, because Scala is not even, you know, officially out there. And you have this major site that uses it and shows kind of, you know, a proof of concept that this is a living, functioning language that is able to carry the heavy load of, like, they said, like 5,000 tweets per, I don't know, second, or Microsoft, I don't know, some statistic like that. And it was done using like 1,500 lines of Scala code, and the code is open. And that made me dig a little deeper into like the open source aspects of Scala. And I don't think there's a BioScala project yet. What's cool is that people are leveraging these open source, languages and tools really quickly to use it and put it out there. And the rest of the community is barely even catching up. And it's exciting that this innovation is happening so quickly that, you know, Scala was nowhere like 3 years back. And now, you know, there's a major website that uses Scala significantly. And that's what excited me about the moment I saw your database scaling concept, you know, post that you'll talk about shortly. I said, hey, this is kind of like when Twitter used Scala to quickly solve, you know, it is like a new language, and it really helped them use a lot of meta concepts to speed up their database updates. So, and that was just the
cool part. And I mean, Twitter's to address some of their scaling issues, they've got quite a few new things that they put in. So they have their Scala front end. They have this thing called Kestrel that they use for message queuing.
Yeah, so Kestrel is the one, I guess, that they wrote, which they use a lot of Scala code for.
Yeah.
So.
So yeah, and it's basically a port of think of something called Starling, which many people have heard of, which is written in Ruby, and they basically ported Starling over to Scala to handle their particular needs.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a whole blog post, and they have this thing called Cache Money, which is like Memcached. It's a caching mm-hmm. thing. It's a Rails based. It plugs in directly into Active Record, so which is, I guess, what they're using for the caching layer, because they're a Rails based app primarily. And things like that. So it's very interesting. The two posts that I put up there, one was on database sharding, which I know nothing about. And one was from LinkedIn on something called Project Voldemort, which caught my attention because I actually had a project of that name when I was at Rosetta, which is my pet project. They stole my name. But basically, the whole all of these are about how do you scale database lookup?
Yeah, right.
How do you scale sites that are reading or writing really hard. And I think the writing problem is the one that's interesting, right, for most life science apps.
Right.
Because we're never going to see Twitter's traffic.
There's
not a single, no life science site mm-hmm. in the world will ever be a fraction of Twitter.
True.
So what I find encouraging is that, going back to your Scala thing, actually, I got introduced to Scala by a blog post in 2007 by Tiago.
Tiago, I was reading that earlier today, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I actually just put it up in our bookmarked it to C2C bio. We can put it up in the show notes.
Yeah, Tiago said he started looking at it, but then he moved back to Ruby. But that was a year ago, and I heard a lot of Scala's progress has been in the last, 6 months.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if there's, some bio Scala, bioinformatics Scala stuff. I want to learn more about it. It sounds cool.
Languages are getting so fun these days, aren't they?
Yeah, and everybody's putting so much energy into them. That's what's cool,
And, Jan and Pierre and all these guys were in Japan for Bio Hackathon. Jan was representing Bio Ruby. There was people representing Bio Perl, Bio Python, Bio Java.
Right.
And then Pierre was there. He got invited, expenses paid kind of trip.
Wow.
So all these guys are geeking out in Tokyo.
That's awesome. Yeah.
But getting back to the whole scalability part, and sort of especially with the amount of data we're generating nowadays, it'll be interesting to see how people in the life science space start thinking about just not just a big 100 gigabyte memory database.
So that database sharding thing was cool, right? Because they're talking about, splitting your one big database into, he gave an example of you put all the odd users on one database and put all the even users on the other database.
Yeah.
And then you can actually gain performance benefits because if the moment a user query comes in, you just half the amount of time required to perform a select. Things like that, which are very straightforward concepts, but these guys have actually gone and implemented it, and it works well to scale these very large things. And did you see this thing about in the Voldemort thing about, I guess, Amazon's Dynamo?
That's Amazon's. So if the MapReduce paper is a seminal paper for distributed computing, the Amazon Dynamo paper is the main biggest paper in distributed storage.
Oh, okay.
It's like the MapReduce equivalent of it's like there is a published paper which Amazon published on how they build really fault tolerant, really distributed key value data stores. It's a mm-hmm. reference paper.
Wow.
Built on technology that Amazon uses internally. Mm-hmm. S3, SimpleDB use similar. You use parts of that technology.
I see.
They're not Dynamo, but they have a lot of the philosophy is present in those.
Very cool.
It's meant for lots of concurrency, works under the concept mm-hmm. that things break down. So how do you handle load? How do you handle distribution? How do you mm-hmm. do it inexpensively without spending money on huge boxes? A lot of this whole key value data store concepts have come out of things like from the Dynamo papers. The Project Voldemort is that I've started seeing a lot of chatter on Hacker News on something called Tokyo. I forget what it's called. Tokyo Box, Tokyo Bento, Tokyo something, Tokyo Cabinet, which is also a key value store. Of course, there's things like CouchDB, there's Bigtable. In fact, that was an interesting thing at this meeting I was at, that there was this whole people. I spoke about it, the Google guy spoke about it, Jimmy spoke about it. This distributed key value fault tolerant data stores and how they can scale and improve. And it'll be interesting to see how people in the life sciences start using up some of these technologies. We don't face the same scale problems necessarily, but and even things like database sharding, I don't understand it, but every fifth, sixth post on Hacker News, sometimes it feels is about data sharding. Yeah, and how Facebook does it versus how Yahoo does it versus how somebody else does it. So, and I guess most of the big database engines now have support for that built in. So,
Cool.
yeah, it's interesting stuff. So, anyway, so that was our programming geekery for the day. Did you have anything else to talk about today, or should we jump on to our links of the week?
Yeah, what, how long have you been going?
We have been going for 40 minutes, 41
All right,
almost.
yeah, we should probably wrap up then.
Yeah.
Hey, did you catch that awesome presentation on wearable computing?
No, I haven't had a chance to check it out
Okay,
yet.
yeah, all right,
Yeah.
then we'll talk about that next week. It's kind of
Yeah.
very cool. Anyway,
Yeah.
so
I was picturing all kinds of yeah. Let's talk about it next time.
yeah, cool. And all right, so you, all right, this time I'll go first with the links of the week
Okay.
because I guess you. So it's actually it's a blog, I guess. Eli Benderski, have you heard of the guy? I don't know if he's anyway. So he has a blog which it's basically a place where he puts code snippets. So in that sense, it's kind of like Pierre Liedenbaum's blog, but his code snippets are he's more. I mean, not directly bioinformatics focused. It's a very good blog, and the reason is that he writes very focused articles on various aspects of programming. For example, like he has posts on like plotting, for example, and he tries three or four libraries for plotting and then says, all right, this is my best library and here's the problem I solved using it. And I was trying to write this code for reading data from one of our voltmeters, and I came upon his blog post, and within like 150 lines of code, which I stole from him, I could get it working. So it's a very cool blog for all things code and geeky code projects and concepts and so on. So it's Eli thegreenplace.net, and his name is Eli Benderski. So it's a cool blog.
Cool. Definitely should check it out. I like, blogs. I mean, obviously Pierre's blog is sort of the like in the life science space is the one that a lot of people look to because whatever he writes, he ends up putting the code out there. Mine's a lot geekier. My link of the week is a thing called the Spectral Game. It's actually a game written by which is brought being brought to life by some very familiar people. The URL is kind of funky, so I'll just put that in the show notes. So the
It's
Spectral
not
Game?
spectralgame.com, is it?
No, it isn't. At least
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right.
It might be the one I have resolves to some EDU address.
Okay.
The Spectral Game was developed by Jean-Claude Bradley, Andrew Lang, and Anthony Williams. The conception is by Jean-Claude and Andrew, who actually built a similar game in Second Life for the students. But now it's a web page.
Yeah, okay, it's
Yeah.
spectralgame.com actually.
Oh,
I'm looking at
so
it.
that works. Let me type that out. Spectralgame.com.
All one
Yeah,
word.
it's that one. Same thing. And so yeah, so it's really cool. It's you basically every round you get presented with a new spectrum and you have to select the molecule that matches the spectrum.
Cool.
So you get a point and you continually go wrong and it's a great way of teaching chemistry,
Hey,
right?
this is so neat.
Yeah, so it's all NMR spectra as far as I know
Hey,
right now.
actually, and speaking of teaching, I actually screwed up last week in our links of the week. I actually only talked about Stephen Curry, but when I actually meant to be talking more about P212121.com. And if you're a crystallographer, you know exactly what that is.
Even I know what that is.
Okay, sorry. Yes. That was the other blog. And it's the same thing. There's a lot of cool things there on like teaching crystallography concepts. So anyway, sorry, just an addendum. And along these lines, thanks to Vlad and some of our other listeners who pointed out obvious omissions in our show notes in the past. So if you guys definitely notice things that we've left out of the show notes, please do let us know. That's really cool to get that feedback.
I should add that thanks for all the support. We've been getting some great feedback and it makes us makes it that much more fun.
And Chris actually emailed the guys at nThought, and that was really awesome of you, Chris. And I mean, nThought's amazing. I mean, their Python distribution is super useful. And I've actually started playing with the Traits UI, which is, anyway, all the Python people will probably know what that is. Maybe one future episode when I actually know something, I'll talk about
Yeah, excellent. The usual thing, you can find us on iTunes or on spokenword.org, and you can always send email to hari@bioscreencast.com or leave a comment on the blog, and we are easy to find.
C2cbio.com.
Is the place to go if you ever want to see the website. That's it for today, and see you next week.
All righty. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Oh my, the Vista always like logs me out. Even though it's recording in the background, it's quite hilarious. All right, let me hit stop.